Javat, I was thinking as we were chanting, remember I told you there are mysteries about Vrindavan? Ah, so there's a mystery also about this place. A very special mystery. It's interesting because Lord Chaitanya appears in this world, Radha and Krishna come together in the form of Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya performs very mysterious pastimes also. And he also teaches the way to chant Hare Krishna properly. He didn't write a lot of books, but he gave his Shikshastakam prayers that a serious person, if you want to be serious, you must study those prayers. And our teachers in our line have given commentaries on those prayers and explained for us their relevance and importance. Now, most of us, I'm speaking for myself, I live in a Western environment. And I'm exposed to what I would say is a European, Greek-based Christian culture. And so in that environment, Indian theology or Krishna consciousness doesn't seem to be what the people are after. I'm sure you have this experience. The educational system will educate you in Western values. It will educate you towards a culture, as I said, based on Greek theology. And therefore you'll hear that India has all these gods and goddesses. And of course they're all what? What are they? All these gods and goddesses, they're simply mythology. Mythology, it means they're nice stories, they're good stories, they help you be a good person here. So the difficulty is that culture, and it's predominant all over the world, even in India, more and more as the years go by, this culture says, this is life, this is it, this is the whole thing is right here and now. Enjoy it. Have a good time. Make as much money as you can. Go to as many places that are fascinating and see them, because this is our world. And we shouldn't mess it up. We are messing up our world. We're not treating the whales properly. We're not treating the earth planet properly. We're not doing these things. We should fix all these things. And then what? And then we should have a good time. And so even when you see wars fought, Russia and Ukraine, Israel and Gaza, every war you'll see that on both sides, both parties are thinking, if only that person or that country was out of here, we could enjoy life in the real way. Whether I'm this religion, that religion, whatever it is, this is the world, this is the place, we should enjoy it. And so living in that culture, it either grossly or subtly, it affects us. We also carry a little of that sense. This is the world. We should make the world a better place. That's our business. If we don't do that, we're not being good citizens. And so when we come to Vraj, I'm speaking for myself, but I think it must be true for others. When I come to Vraj, there's a part of me that still holds on to that impression, that conditioning, and says, this is nice, this is Vrindavan, it's a special place, I'm glad I know about Vrindavan, it makes my life, enriches my life, but it isn't everything, it can't be everything. How can it be everything? I have a life to lead, I have a future ahead of me. And so when I perceive that way of thinking affecting me, then I notice that it eases off my interest in Vrindavan. Vrindavan almost appears to become mythology. Nice stories. Krishna, Krishna, Hari, Hari, Rama, Rama, it's nice. and it makes me happy, and you know, I have a good life. And then I noticed for myself at this age, perhaps not when I was much younger, that I immediately there's a sense of alarm, because time is running out, and soon there's going to be a change taking place. And what am I going to be thinking about? Am I going to be thinking about the Western culture and saving the whales and so many things? Or women's rights or men's rights or this right and that right? Or am I going to be saying, there's something beyond all of this. I don't understand it properly. I seriously don't understand it properly. But I've heard enough to know that that is reality. And I don't know what to do with that. Yes, I know, I chant my rounds, I do chant my rounds, get up in the morning, I do this, I do that, but my mind is kind of seems to be anchored to here. So when we come to Vrindavan, I think many of us come with this challenge. And sometimes we think, well, if I lived here, it would be all right. If I don't go back there, it'll be all right. And to some degree, that's correct, because there's the atmosphere of the Dham. But then there's also the atmosphere of our impressions that we already have. And there's also the atmosphere of what you see in Vrindavan right now, the commercialization of Vrindavan, the commercialization of this place, the commercialization of that place. And you watch the local people radically enthusiastic about it. And again, you think, what am I doing? How come they're not serious? It's their place. It's a holy place. Why are they massively building guest houses and hotels? When I was speaking to a gentleman last year, he has a shop in Vrindavan, he said 20 years ago there were no hotels in Vrindavan, not even one, only dharamshalas. And he said now there must be 200. So what is this? This is a spiritual tourism aimed at making a good life for yourself, live in the holy Dham, and enjoy life, make money, have a good time, and so on. So what happens is those two things don't go well together, because it's like oil and water. You pour them in together, the water is oily and the oil is wet, and neither of them work very well together. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to hear in a clear way from those who have realization. And that's not me. I'm like a speaker on behalf of. I speak on behalf of what I have learned from Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, the Goswamis themselves, what they have written, what they have said. And of course, in the mood that I don't know anything, but they do, and so if I repeat to you what they say, it may have a very beneficial effect on your consciousness. So when I was preparing for the retreat, Govardhan retreat this year, I had decided to read in summary form the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, which is an amazing book by Sanatan Goswami. And if anyone has seen it, it comes in three volumes, this thick, this high, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, thousands of words. And I had to take two of those volumes and reduce them into 5 3,000 word presentations, from 50,000 words to 3,000. And so needless to say, what that meant was so many amazing things had to be set aside just to get the flow of the story. And if anyone was to read those books or has read them, they'll know that they're beyond this world, completely beyond this world, because the consciousness of Sanatana Goswami was beyond this world. The last class I had to give was when the hero of the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, he's called Gopakumar. He's a little cowherd boy from Govardhan who's got a mantra. It's a Gopal mantra. That means that's a mantra for somebody who wants to serve Gopal or Krishna as a cowherd boy. He chants his mantra. He's very innocent. In fact, you could say he's ignorant. On the way here, I was thinking, what are the characteristics that a villager has? Because all these people are villagers. And I was thinking, they're rough, very rough. They're very resilient. They don't care. They don't have cares. They don't have concerns like educated people have. And they just sort of live life. And this boy was blessed to remain like that by his guru. He was blessed to remain ignorant, practically speaking, of anything other than what little he knew as he was going on with his journey. And he proceeded upwards. He'd hear something, he'd be interested in that, he'd go there. He was looking always for the Lord of the universe. So he, first of all, he went to the bank of the Ganga, he met a Brahmin, he said, this is Shalagram, Lord of the universe. He focused on that. But then he put the Shalagram in a box. And he said, why do you put the Lord of the universe in a box? And he said, oh, because I'm a poor man. This is the best worship I can do. And he thought, this isn't good enough. And so the Brahmin was very patient, and he said to him, little rough boy, he said, if you want to see better, you go to the king of this place. He's a real worshiper. He's got a big temple, and lots of things are happening there. And the little boy just said, thank you, and off he went. And he continued like that. He went first there, then he went to Jagannath Puri, which we all have heard of. And there he saw Lord Jagannath, and he was full of love for Lord Jagannath. And he would stand in front of Lord Jagannath for hours and hours and just look at him. And he felt, now my life is complete. I'm seeing the Lord of the universe. But then somebody came and said something. He had something didn't quite suit him in the situation, and he ended up going back to Vrindavan. From Vrindavan, he ended up going to Swargaloka because he heard that there are such people as demigods. Now, he didn't know anything about that. And that was fascinating, that there are higher beings. And so he went up, and there he saw the Lord of the universe that was worshipped there. He stayed for some time, and then he heard that there are higher planets with different opulences and different qualities. And he kept chanting all the time his mantra, his Gopal mantra, and he found he was able to step up to the next place and the next place and so on. So he continued a long journey until eventually he was in Brahmaloka, and that's the topmost place in the universe. And then from there he heard, somebody came and said, you know there's such a thing as liberation or moksha? That means you can get out of the whole material world? And he thought, oh, that's interesting. And so he chanted his mantra, he spoke to people, and people kind of told him that there's a form of the Lord who is either personal or impersonal. And if you go and see him, you will benefit. It will take you further on your journey. So he went there. And then he went on to Vaikuntha, he went on to Ayodhya, he went to Dwarka. And in every place, what he was looking for wasn't there. Because what he was looking for was the ultimate intimacy of sweetness. He was a village boy. He wanted to climb on the back of Krishna, hug him, kiss him, have him kiss him, run in the fields, sleep with the cows, play all the games that the boys played. This was his nature. And so in every place, it wasn't quite fulfilled. So the last class that I was to give was on Gopakumar entering into Goloka Vrindavan, or the spiritual realm in the spiritual sky. And I thought, wow, this is so heavy. I don't know anything about this. And I can summarize and I can cut out words and so on. But how will I share this with others so that they grasp it? Because I also need to grasp it. And so I started looking around. I started praying for help. And I started looking for quotes and anything from any of our line of teachers. And I came across, in that searching for what is that place like, how do I share that? It's the penultimate transcendental abode, I came across something written by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And alongside of what he was speaking about, there was another article that he had written. And in that article, the second one, he was speaking about the difference between what's called parakīya and swakīya. So parakīya means a love that is outside the boundaries of marriage. And swakīya means a married love. And it's very interesting because the six Goswamis, they wrote down our philosophy. But Srila Rupa Goswami wrote certain principles, and Srila Jiva Goswami, as the next representative, wrote apparently very differently. So Srila Rupa Goswami said that this swakīya, the love of Radha and Krishna that does not contain a marriage ceremony, is the highest thing. And Srila Jiva Goswami says in his writing, no, this is just an illusion in the material world. In the spiritual world, Radha and Krishna are married. So then there has been different debates on this subject. Who's right? One says this, one says that, and so forth. But the wisdom of our teachers says there can't be a mundane difference here, because they're both of the same caliber. They both have the same understanding. But they're emphasizing something different, ultimately to protect the people. Because perhaps this idea of Radha and Krishna loving without marriage will be seen as something that we say, oh, we can do that too. And then that will bring down the standard of morality of the people. At the same time, if we say that Radha and Krishna must be married to meet, then that limits Krishna. He has to follow the rules of all the people of the world. But the difficulty is that Krishna is beyond this world. He's beyond the rules of this world because he has no impurity. He has no lust. He has no whimsical, non-transcendental love, as we see sometimes in this world. So Javat is the place where Srimati Radharani is apparently married. She lives here. Her father built a beautiful palace for her with a moon tower, which is just on the top, all decorated with silver swans. And she would go up to the top of this moon tower at the top of the building and look towards Nandagram. And Krishna would go, he'd tell his mother, he just had his meal, I'll go and sit on the roof. He'd go up there and he would look towards Javat. And the poignancy of this love that exists with obstacles is the subject matter of so many of the writings of our acharyas. Now, it can be misunderstood. It can be misused if somebody wants to do that. And so we see, for example, there's a TV series made, and they have Abhimanyu there as a real-life person. Radharani's married. It's like she's performing an adulterous relationship with Krishna, a sort of tragic love affair, like maybe Romeo and Juliet or something like that. And that's because most people don't have the guidance that we have. So we must become, all of us, because we're so blessed to have come in touch with this line, we must become gradually learned so that we ourselves can push back on that tendency to see in the way the world sees. So Radha and Krishna are eternally one. We know that. And this love, which has no, what could I say, almost no legal binding, is superior. Because if you say, listen, you know, I'm your wife, you have to do this for me. Or he says, oh, my wife, you have to do this for me. That's of one standard. That's called swakya, or married love. But the love of the gopis is so total that they don't have any certificate. They don't have any, you could say, any official public right to love Krishna publicly. They love Krishna in a very secret way. And they meet Krishna in a very special way. And when Krishna leaves Vrindavan, they never forget for a moment Krishna. They don't go, they're not part of the family, they don't have those kind of roles. They love Krishna secretly, deeply, passionately, and only. So this is the nature of Radha and Krishna's love. Radharani doesn't see anything but Krishna. She and the gopis are like the highest level of devotion because they're not divided. They don't have children. Excuse me, I've got to take care of the children. You know, oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. No, they have one thing. They love Krishna exclusively. So coming to Javad, unfortunately, this is the second time, we'll have to work this out. There's a temple on the hill, which is the main temple, and this is a beautiful place, and we're so happy to be here. But in the temple on the hill, you'll see Radha Kanta together, Radha and Krishna. And as I told you, everything in Braj is for Krishna's pleasure. Every atomic particle is serving Krishna's pleasure. And so there you see it's a temple, but it's the place, more or less, not literally, but it represents the place where Radharani lived in this house built by her father. Her husband, Abhimanyu, is a mysterious character. I told you there's lots of mysteries here. He doesn't even touch Radharani's shadow. He can't have any connection with her. But he sort of feels that he does. She's his wife. And he goes out. He's very busy taking care of the cows. And Radharani is always trying to work out how to meet Krishna, how to be with Krishna. And the more obstacles, the higher the love goes. You know, we see this in the movies, right? The most tragic movie is the one that everybody goes, oh, that was an amazing movie. It was so sad, you know. And everybody is enthralled by that suspense and that conflict and that obstruction. So Radharani stays here, always thinking about Krishna. She feels this place is like being in prison. And once in the day, she goes in the morning to cook for Krishna. Because Mother Yasoda always thinks that Radharani is married to Krishna. That's how she thinks. They're like husband and wife. So she's always asking Radha should come and do this. And Jyotila is the mother-in-law. She's a foil. She's like, what? She's my daughter-in-law. You can't ask her to come like that to the house of another man. That's not proper. You know, and so she's always trying to get in the way between Radha and Krishna. And in this way, because our rule is that every single particle here is meant to enhance Krishna's pleasure, we can understand that Jyotila Devi is also enhancing Krishna's pleasure. By all her obstructions and all the things she does and says, she calls Krishna names, you terrible person, don't come near my daughter-in-law, you know, you're like this, like that. And constantly Radha and Krishna are meeting and sharing exchanges based on this, how to get around Jyotila, how to get around and do this and do that. And some of the stories are very funny. And one time Krishna came and he got up in a tree, a bigger tree than this, just outside where Radharani lives. And he started to make the sound of a cuckoo. And he'd make this sound and it was nighttime. And Radharani immediately knew that's Krishna. And so what she would do, she would come very quietly down the stairs. And Jyotila would hear this sound outside and she'd say, who is that? What is that? And Krishna would be quiet. And then again, as soon as she was sleeping again, he'd make this cuckoo sound and Radharani would come and her bangles might clatter a little bit. And Jyotila would wake up and she would call something out, shout out the window, who is this, what is this? No, no, there are no cuckoos in the middle of the night. And so they would go on and on throughout the night, Radha trying to meet Krishna, Krishna trying to meet Radha, and Jatila in the middle. And in so many ways, Krishna would make his way into Javad, meet Radharani right under Jyotila's nose, and she didn't know. And Radharani had opportunities to escape, and she would meet Krishna in the forest. But these beautiful pastimes are completely devoid of the lust that you would see in an adulterous situation, where there is some degree of morality and immorality involved, because Krishna's pastimes go on a totally different plane. So we're very blessed actually to come here, even though some of these things may be over our heads. We may sort of even wonder, I don't know the relevance of this for me. But at some point later in your life, you might think back and go, wow, you know, I went to that place. I visited Krishna, Kishori Kund. I visited Javad. Let me go there again. Now, I'd like to see that place again. So these visits, coming, going, take with you what you can. And know that whatever you take with you is of immense value. And it will help you in your life to steer clear of the idea that this world is the be-all and end-all of existence, because it isn't. And this is the message that Srila Prabhupada traveled around the world wanting to give. And the result of his efforts, the result of his preaching and speaking and teaching, is that we're all here. If he hadn't done that, we wouldn't be here. Every last one of us is here because of him. Directly, directly, indirectly, somehow, we have touched his message, or we wouldn't be here. So here we are in Kishori Kund. And I hope that you all can take some water. This is a good place to get water. Anyone who's collecting water on behalf of everyone, Kishori Kund's a good place. There's some very nice leaves around, if anyone is interested. A little dust here and there. So take advantage of being here. Hare Krishna. Thank you.